This episode of the Vermont Conversation is brought to you by the Children's Literacy Foundation, or CLIF. Based in Waterbury Center, CLIF is a nonprofit organization that provides new books, in-person author visits, and inspiring literacy programs to kids and families across Vermont and New Hampshire. CLIF partners with schools, libraries, shelters, community centers, childcare programs, correctional facilities, and many other sites with the goal of helping under-resourced children discover the joys of reading and writing. To learn more about CLIF, visit their website at CLIF, that's CLIFonline.org.
It's so special to be named a Rhodes Scholar as a Vermonter. People have such a special attachment to Vermont, even if they're not from there. It occupies this really beautiful place in their mind. It's a place of respite and joy and progressivism. And it was special for me to be there and to see the way that Vermont is being responded to.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. It's been nearly two decades since a Vermonter won a coveted Rhodes Scholarship, which is widely considered the most prestigious international scholarship. The Rhodes Scholarship pays for students from around the world to pursue postgraduate studies for up to 3 years at Oxford University in England. Vermont's scholarship drought was broken this week when Lena Ashew of Shelburne was named a 2025 Rhodes Scholar. She is one of 32 Rhodes Scholars chosen from the U.S. from over 3,000 students who applied. According to the Rhodes Trust, Vermont has had 43 Rhodes Scholars since the first group was named in 1903. The last Rhodes Scholar from Vermont was in 2006. Lena Ashew graduated from Champlain Valley Union High School in 2021. At CVU, Ashew was active with 4-H, and she founded Mi Vida, Mi Voz, My Life, My Voice, a group that brought together the children of migrant farm workers in Vermont with other youth to share stories and discuss how to make change. In 2020, Lena was named one of Vermont's top youth volunteers and was recognized with a National Prudential Spirit of Community Award. Lena is now a senior at Harvard. She designed and is pursuing Harvard's first major in animal studies, an interdisciplinary program that combines philosophy, psychology, biology, and political science. She explained that animal studies is a way to study social injustice. Lena is co-president of Harvard College Animal Advocates, and while in college, she has lobbied legislators on environmental justice, worked as an intern for Vermont Representative Becca Ballant, and has done research in Puerto Rico on macaque monkeys. She also plays the classical harp. At Oxford, Ashew plans to study animal ethics and address the question, what does it mean to respect an animal as an individual? I began by asking Lena Ashew how she developed her love of animals and how it relates to other issues that concern her.
So a formative experience of mine growing up in Vermont was being a part of the 4-H and getting to exhibit brown Swiss dairy cows. And through this opportunity, I got to meet other young Vermonters who either came from farming families or were interested in becoming farmers themselves or wanted to see what the experience of being a farmer in Vermont might be like. So I spent 10 years between the age of 8 and 18 a part of this program and became very invested in it and became invested in the farming community in Vermont. And about halfway through this experience started in a bit more of an intentional and systematic way, speaking to farmers across the state and their families about the experience of being farm workers. I think if you looked at what my parents do, it would be very surprising that I became very invested in the farm worker community or was able to have this experience working and speaking to and having, especially my summers, be devoted to spending time with other young people that were involved in the farming industry, because both of my parents are professors and they're both ethical vegetarians. My dad teaches about the ethics of eating animals and animal products. And my mom, for as long as I can remember, has just had a real keen eye for the plight and suffering of animals. But I think having these two forces in my life at a young age made me appreciate the intricacies and complexity of our food system, and made me appreciate the way our food system functions from a on the ground kind of personal level.
All right, so let's go to what you study. You designed a major in animal studies. You're the first person to pursue this field of study at Harvard. There's a lot of majors that are already made for you: economics, government, the traditional things. Why did you design your own, and what is this program of study that you've created in animal studies?
So I've always said that studying animal studies is a way of studying social injustice. And my way of understanding this is through the early experiences, which I've already mentioned, of working on a dairy farm, because I realized that the way that animals were being mistreated were tied to ways that people that were really important to me and in communities that I really cared about were also having their freedom to choose how they were participating in the system restricted. So I saw that looking at the ways that animals were mistreated or their freedom was being restricted also allowed us to attend to ways that people, and specifically I think vulnerable people, are also being mistreated, being subjected to exploitation or to disease and illness and pollution from farms.
And this connects to your experience when you were a student at Champlain Valley Union High School, getting to know Vermont's migrant farm workers. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you first get to know some of the people working on Vermont's dairy farms?
Yeah, I think our pandemic provides an opportunity to really understand the urgency of how the ways that animals are mistreated might be tied to the ways that people are mistreated as well. I think this number is staggering, but during the pandemic, 60 to 100,000 animals were killed en masse. And the people that were responsible for killing those animals are the people that are largely employed in large-scale factory farms, and they're already the most vulnerable of our society. They're low-income people, people of color, and people that are lacking citizenship documents. And so these figures don't surprise me, but I think they show me the urgency of this system and these issues. And as you mentioned, when I w had been showing cows and spending time at fairs and spending time with farm worker families, I became enveloped into a community of migrant farm workers, in part because of connections I had at the Vermont Migrant Education Program. And you might be surprised to know that migrant, in the way that the Vermont Migrant Education Program defines the term, encompasses anybody who is moving every 2 years to seek employment on farms. So it could be multi-generational Vermont farming families, or it could be people that are new to the state. And so I had the opportunity to start organizing, or I did start organizing, these storytelling conferences that eventually became a nonprofit, but brought together everybody who was interested in participating, who was under the age of 21, who fell into this category of being a migrant.
And
And they
this
were.
is the nonprofit you founded as a high school student, Mi Vida, Mi Voz. Explain what that organization did or does, and what it means.
Yeah, so mi vida, mi voz, in Spanish means my life, my voice. And while I was in high school, I began to work on a few political campaigns. And one thing I noticed in the way that it seemed like Vermonters who were voting and the ways that people in these political discussions were talking about farm workers differed from how farm workers were discussing their own experiences. And I thought it seemed like there was a place for migrant farm workers to have an opportunity to articulate their experiences in the food system in Vermont and to be a part of reimagining what the future of farming in the state might look like. So I called it My Life, My Voice, because that was a central tenet of the storytelling conferences, was that, the people that are being most impacted by the state's dairy industry should be telling their stories and articulating their own experiences. There's a great book by Teresa Mayers, who's at the University of Vermont, called Life on the Other Border, where she explains how migrant families in Vermont, especially those that are working on farms, are equal parts hyper visible and also absent from the Vermont landscape. And so Mi Vida, Mi Voz was an opportunity to create a really safe, warm, welcoming space. They were cost-free conferences for migrant farm workers to articulate their own experiences. And we organized three events that were cost-free, that brought together farm workers from across the state, that took place at some kind of retreat in Vermont. And we brought in artists and educators and activists from around the country to lead storytelling workshops. And these conferences were organized in partnership with the Vermont Migrant Education Program, who works year-round, has been around for decades, and is a federally funded program to provide services and resources to migrant farm workers in the state.
Is this is it still going on, Mi Vida, Mi Voz?
Mi Vida, Mi Voz, unfortunately, is not still going on. And I've always, it's something that I really hope to return to when I return back to Vermont. The program kind of got adopted by the Vermont Migrant Education Program, but the nonprofit is not active.
Is there one anecdote that you recall from when, youth from other countries who are working here, your interactions with them?
I mentioned earlier that a large focus of Mi Vida, Mi Voz was taking seriously that migrant farm workers should be part of the discussions about reimagining the future of farming in the state. And I remember during the conference, during one of our Mi Vida, Mi Voz conferences, one of the most moving moments for me was a dear friend of mine, Alejandro, who was 15 at the point of the conference and had been working in Vermont for a year, working 70 to 100 hours a week, shared this story and he's an artist. He had created an illustration to accompany his story. He spoke about growing up in Mexico and passing this truck every day with his parents, and it was a truck he really wanted, and a toy truck, and his parents had known that he really wanted the truck but were not able to afford it for him. And he describes coming to the U.S. when he was 15 with the goal of being able to provide for his children the truck that his parents couldn't provide for him. And I thought the way that he described his motivations were really striking, because he didn't describe them solely as being able to provide for his children something that he wasn't able to have. But he also described wanting to... being moved by seeing his parents distraught about not being able to provide him the truck, and not wanting there to be that same sort of guilt or relationship between parents and their children. So I just thought it was a really striking story and moment, in part because it was the first time he was able to take a weekend away from work and eat good food and have a really comfortable stay in a kind of hotel-like setting and meet other kids from around the state and talk to artists and, Yeah, it was a moving moment.
I wonder what this political season has been like for you, where immigrants have been so targeted as, you know, enemies, criminals, and talk of mass deportation. You know the people, the faces of these immigrants, and they're at great risk right now. I wonder what that has felt like for you.
I think something that I've learned through this election that's been central to my work is what happens when we start articulating people's experiences, and including their experiences of suffering or of oppression for them. I think that's what started to happen this election, or at least one part of it that I was able to understand was that people around the country felt like they were having their beliefs and experiences articulated for them in the ways that they were being articulated or described did not actually match how they felt. And I think what I can offer from my experiences working in Vermont was that once you free yourself from the impulse to articulate what somebody's experience might be like, you might open up the door for there to be new grounds for people to realize that their experiences are connected. I remember during one of the Mi Vida Mi Voz conferences, the conference was being held in both Spanish and English, and we had translators who were at the event, one of the biggest conferences we held, who were at the event helping to move between the two languages. And I remember a young boy who had come from a multi-generational family of Vermont farmers. He kind of stood up at the during one of the workshops, after somebody had spoken in Spanish and had been translated to English, and said, "You know, I work on this farm with my father, and everybody around me is speaking Spanish other than my father. And I don't know why it is that they're all speaking Spanish." He was very frustrated. It seemed like he was, you know, expressing this frustration about there being these Spanish-speaking people on his farm. And I think if you had heard him initially, your impression might have been that he was expressing some sort of young nativism.
This was the farmer who was speaking?
Yes, it was he probably was 10, a young boy. And, you know, we really valued at the conference taking seriously what everybody was saying. That was a real value of Mi Vida Mi Voz. And so we kind of, you know, it was a little bit, there was some silence after what he said, because it was unclear if it was potentially an early kind of bigoted, I don't know why all of these Spanish speakers are on my farm. But after some time, I realized what he seemed to be expressing. And after he started speaking a little bit more about it, what he seemed to be expressing was loneliness on his farm. He didn't know why he couldn't speak Spanish with the people that he was surrounded by. And his father was working all the time. So I think our initial impulse to assume that people's motivations are bigoted and not tied in something like, you know, a real, something that's the product of economic disorder, maybe, or a system that's not functioning correctly, and some loneliness that comes from it. I think we're overlooking some of the dynamics of what's occurring. And so I think, yeah, it's going to be very disturbing to see what happens under this new administration to these communities that I really care about. And I think there's a lesson to learn as well about opening up the opportunity for people to explain their experiences and motivations to us.
So what exactly will you be doing at Oxford? How long will you be there, and what will you study?
I'm currently in the process of applying to Oxford, so we'll see what the future holds based on which programs I'm admitted to, but I will be applying to the Faculty of Philosophy, so the philosophy department at Oxford, to study for a BPhil in philosophy, which I hope to extend to a DPhil, so a doctorate degree. And I'm at this moment, another thing that we'll see if the future holds a different path, but I'm interested at the moment in studying what it means to respect an animal as an individual. Because I think this is an area of philosophical inquiry where new philosophical concepts about what an individual is and what it means to respect an individual could help us enshrine in legal bodies, in policy, a conceptualization of respecting somebody as an individual that could better protect them from extraction or exploitation or other forms of mistreatment in unjust systems. There's been a lot of work done at Oxford in the Faculty of Philosophy on what it means to respect a person, a human person, as an individual. And these philosophical concepts have become used in affirmative action, in the affirmative action rulings, for example, where philosophers have said we need to take somebody's race into account to respect them as an individual. But there's not been much theorizing done. And I think there's a real opportunity to theorize how we should respect animals' individuality. And my hope is that working on this question seriously in as it pertains to animals might give us better philosophical concepts to be applied with humans as well, that can enable us to ensure that each person's individual value and the valuing of their contributions can be protected.
I find your kind of path so interesting because you move between the worlds of philosophy and deep thinking and, you know, talk of, you know, ancient modes of government and thinking and the very practical sphere. You've been an intern for Representative Becca Ballant. You've worked for an environmental justice organization in California, and you're obviously a keen observer and participant in politics and I won't say the real world. This is all the real world, but you know, a world where philosophers often don't necessarily want to get their hands dirty. So I wonder how you hope to make a difference, where you want to locate yourself in these worlds of ideas and the worlds of practical applied things.
What a wonderful question. A large part of my heart is in the philosophy world. And I spent, I wouldn't say I spent to the start of my undergraduate degree in the philosophy world, but I was definitely drawn down this path of studying philosophy and in being in a very theoretical space. But a large part of my heart is also in the practical world. And I've been very influenced by this center at Harvard called the Edmund J. Safra Center for Practical Ethics, which helps undergraduate students who are interested in bringing ethics into whatever discipline they're in forefronting ethics and the ethical demands placed on them as a practitioner. And they've helped me, I think, remain straddled between the philosophy space and the practical space. When I went to the Hill 2 years ago and worked for Congressman Ballant, I realized that a lot of what I had been studying in philosophy was not obviously actionable to me when I was there. I think I had this impression that what I would be studying in philosophy would all of a sudden emerge as something I could apply directly to my working goals when I was working as an intern in Congress. But I realized that there was that translation was not super clear. So I had to reshift my thinking about what I hope to achieve by studying philosophy. And I was influenced as well this past summer and was brought some clarity about this translation when I was working at the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, because I was working for an organization that was deeply rooted in this activist social justice tradition that was started by Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Movement. And it involved these really vibrant social justice leaders who are very philosophical in their orientations. The founder of the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, Luke Cole, was a graduate from Harvard Law School, had clearly thought very seriously about the underlying theory behind his conception of justice. But he was an environmental lawyer and spent his career bringing suit in the really practice applied world to harmful exploitative extractive industry. So I think from him, I started to see a little bit more clearly what the role of philosophy was doing in the practice and the application kind of work that I hope to do. And it was, I think the theory is kind of figuring out the underlying motivations and the conception of a brighter future and the reasons for why you might do something that are giving vibrancy and force and kind of spirit to the advocacy work that I feel a real responsibility to engage in now that I have, you know, access to spaces that will enable me to engage in that advocacy work. So the particulars, I think, of what I want to do in practice, I'm still figuring out. I'm influenced by Luke Cole, and I'm very much drawn to the idea of becoming a practicing lawyer and bringing suit to harmful industry and holding them accountable for the harms that communities, people, and animals are sustaining. I also am very drawn to the idea of returning back to Vermont and working in the policy scene. One of my advisors is Kaz Sunstein, and I remember he said states are laboratories for democracy. And I've always found Vermont to be a front runner in spearheading progressive ideas that might change the way the country is thinking about our future and in imagining a more just future. And so I think Vermont would be a very exciting place to return to try out some progressive policies that might help us head down that path towards a brighter future.
And finally, Lena, picking up on that theme, as you reflect on your journey, what's the connection between growing up in Vermont and being named a Rhodes Scholar?
It's so special to be named a Rhodes Scholar as a Vermonter. I was the only Vermonter among all the finalists that were interviewing in District 1, which encompassed Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Maine, and Vermont. And I found, while I was participating in these interviews, talking to all the finalists and all the committee members, that every time I said I was from Vermont, and this is an experience I've had wherever I go, but particularly in New England, people's faces lit up. People have such a, I think, special attachment to Vermont, even if they're not from there. It occupies this really beautiful place in their mind. It's a place of respite and joy and progressivism. And it was special for me to be there and to see the way that Vermont is being responded to, but to know that Vermont has not been represented, I guess, in 18 years in the Rhodes Trust. And so I really carry Vermont with me. And after I received the Rhodes Scholarship, I had many Vermonters, many of whom I didn't know, reach out to me and say that they had followed my work, they had known I was at Harvard, or that they had just seen the news that there was a Vermonter who was named a Rhodes Scholar. And I wrote to many of them saying that they reminded me of home, and it was really beautiful to receive their message, because I think that's a spirit that Vermont holds and that people know about the state. And it was a wonderful moment to celebrate the state that I'm from.
Well, Lena Ashio, I want to congratulate you on being named a Rhodes Scholar, and thank you for telling your story on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you again for having me here, David. Such a pleasure.
Lena Ashew from Shelburne, Vermont, is a senior at Harvard University. She was recently named a 2025 Rhodes Scholar.